Hello, this is Doug Washburn for the Harford County Public Library. Today is the 20 November 2012. I'm with the Harford Living Treasure, Daniel D. O'Neill of Bel Air. Good morning, sir.
Good morning to you.
I'm glad to meet you. So, tell me what year you were born.
I was born 17th of October, 1931, in the Women's Hospital in Baltimore, Maryland.
Okay. Where were your parents living when you were born?
We were living on William Street, 14 North William Street, in what is now the Mann House.
Okay. And the Mann House is used for today?
It is used for, it's a halfway house for alcoholics.
Okay. What'd your dad do for a living? What'd your mom and dad do for a living?
Well, my mother was a homemaker.
Okay.
And my father was a, of all trades, he started off as a auto salesman. He first established the motor sales, and it was in the 20s, and it was in the blacksmith shop on the corner of Bond Street and Bel Air Road, where the old Kunkel's was, and is now the parking lot for the Harford County office building. And then the motor sales moved to up Bond Street to where the M&T Bank parking lot is. And then when he sold it to Herb Hanna, it moved across the street to where motor sales was during much of the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And is now located on Route 1 down at Benson. It's Bob Bell Chevrolet.
Okay.
And then he went into the banking business, and he was a cashier of the Second National Bank. And during the Depression, they closed the banks, and 5 years later, he worked to merge the Farmers and Merchants National Bank with the Second National Bank to become the First National Bank, where M&T is on Office Street. After many of his children got their college degree in early 40s, he went to the University of Baltimore and got his law degree at 60-some years old, and he practiced law the rest of his life.
Okay, I knew he was a lawyer, but I didn't realize he was that old when he became a lawyer.
And also, when he left the bank in 1935, he started an insurance business as well and operated that while he was a lawyer.
And in the late 40s, he became a Maryland state senator.
A state senator and served for at least one term in Annapolis.
47 to 50 is what I found on the internet.
Okay.
Is what he was listed as. Wow. Okay. Now, I never knew that, I had never heard any name that preceded Hanna and Motor Sales together, so that was very interesting. And for our listeners, the motor sales in the 50s and the 60s would have been where the Mary Bristow Courthouse is today.
Correct. And it was a Chevrolet, Oldsmobile, and Cadillac dealership.
Yep, absolutely. Bought a couple cars there, or my parents bought a couple cars there. So, did you know your grandparents on either maternal or paternal?
Paternal grandmother died when my father was 3 years old, and my grandfather, John B. O'Neill, died before I was born, as well as Thomas Hall Robinson died in the late 20s. It may have been 1929. I'm not sure of the date. And my grandmother, I knew my grandmother and knew her up until I was about 16 years old. She died, I think, in 1948. And they lived on Broadway, now where the Cassleys live, where I think it's Bob Cassley lives, near Franklin Street, just two houses toward Hickory Avenue from Franklin Street.
Okay. Now, your grandfather Robinson, his full name was Thomas Hall Robinson. And he was?
The Attorney General from Maryland during the 20s. And one of the interesting things was in 1970 or 1917 or 1916, he helped procure the original ground for Aberdeen Proving Ground. And it was not as large as it is now. It ended where the firehouse is on the main part, and then it was expanded and during World War II, or before or during World War II.
It was about 35,000 acres there, yeah. I think, of farmland, and another 35,000 acres of marsh.
And one of the treasures of Spasuti Island was part of that acquisition.
Isn't Spasuti where they did a lot of the artillery testing?
They did a lot of bombing. In fact, I had an office building was the old tower for the bombing range on Spasuti building when I worked at Aberdeen Proving Ground.
On your mother's side, you had a grandfather that was associated with St. Ignatius?
Yes, if you go back to my great-great-great-grandfather, Humphrey Wilson, he was most likely one of the attendees at the opening of St. Ignatius Church in 1792. And that began a long line of my association with St. Ignatius. And through that lineage of Humphrey Wilson, I'm related to Dr. Dick Street of the Pools, and to Larry Wilson and his father, Kent Wilson, who was up at Forest Hill Bank.
Yep, downtown Forest Hill.
Yes.
Same time as Harry Heaps.
Right.
Yeah. I see the street with two T's, so
right.
That's obviously the northern street.
Right, this is, and that's Dr. Dick Street, the veterinarian.
Oh, okay. But he would be the same line as Colonel John Street up
Holy
Cross Road.
That is correct.
That's a beautiful property today.
So. And on my father's side, the history goes back to 1795 when my great-great-grandfather, Henry O'Neill, came over from Ireland and settled in the up in the Rocks area. My sister tried to do a lot of research, but we really couldn't find where the post office was and where he actually settled. But that's what we understand. He settled in the Rocks. And his son, John Harden O'Neill, who my brother's named after him, by the way,
okay.
Married Mary Wells Green of Havity Grace. And many will recognize the name Green because there's a Green Street in Havity Grace. And the greenhouse that the real estate agent, Mr. Terry, lived in is on the corner of Green and Union Avenue.
I know there was a Rocks post office on the Rocks Station Road in the later years before it closed, but I don't know about anything earlier.
And my father, when the Civil War came about, wasn't happy being near the North, so he went to Georgia, and he was fought in the Confederate cavalry during the Civil War. And even my grandfather lived in Georgia for a while and finally settled in Baltimore.
Do you know what your great-great-grandfather Henry did in the Rocks?
I don't know that. And his father back in Ireland was Owen, and the only reason I say that is there are a lot of people figure we're related to the John O'Neill of the Lighthouse. And my brother tried to do a lot of genealogy and traveled to Ireland. Brother Jim tried to travel to Ireland 6 or 7 times. And hired a genealogy to trace our family in Northern Ireland, and we could never make a connection between that John O'Neill and our ancestor Henry O'Neill.
Okay. Yeah, when I was doing the research, I found a lot about that particular John O'Neill. So what was What's your earliest memory of growing up in Bel Air?
I don't have much memory when I was six and younger, but I went to school at St. Margaret's on Hickory Avenue, graduated in 1944, and that was in the original schoolhouse, the four-room schoolhouse, where we had two grades. The first and second was in one room, and the second and the third, the third and fourth in another room, and the fifth, sixth, and seventh in the third room. And I graduated in 1944 and then went to Bel Air High School on Gordon Street and graduated in 1948.
The St. Margaret's School, that was not located where the current school is, it?
Yes.
Oh, it is? Okay.
Yes. That was located there. I think maybe way back early it might have been across the street. I'm not sure about that.
Okay. Well, I've heard other folks talk about the earliest of the St. Margaret's being where the parking garage is. Up at Pennsylvania and Hickory?
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
So, but I didn't know whether that building was still
standing. No, I totally was recalled. The little church where the office building is what we had, and then the four-room schoolhouse with an auditorium below.
Okay. Would that have been sisters for the teacher?
Yeah, they were the school sisters in Notre Dame, and they wore their habits, their black habits, and was all starched up, so.
And pretty strict.
Yes. Very strict.
Do you think that the education, the classes that were offered at St. Margaret's were different than public school, or just more stringent?
I think that we had a better foundation, like in English. We declined sentences, and don't know how to compare it to the public school, but I know we got an excellent education that I'm not sure that you get today.
Yeah, even in the public school, the seventh grade was all you were required to attend.
Yes.
In the early years. It was later that they went to the 11th, and even later they went to the 12th. But I've seen the graduation tests from the 1880s, and very stringent.
I was 16 years old when I graduated from high school.
Mm. Oh, now did that mean were you allowed to skip some grades because you come in St. Mark's?
No, I allowed to start when I was five.
Oh.
Since I was born in October.
Okay. Yeah, you were young to graduate.
Yes, I graduated from college when I was 20.
Yeah, that's very young.
I went 1 year to Mount St. Mary's and then graduated in 1952 from Loyola College in Baltimore.
Now, when I called you the other day and we were talking, you were talking about you got your driver's license at what I would call a very young age.
Right. My father had a farm up on, up near Forest Hill in Frogtown, that's what they called it. I can't remember the road where the school is now, the brand new school. What's the name of that?
Friends?
No, the brand new school up in Alpha Vale Road. We had a farm on that road that led into to where I'm drawing out a senior moment.
That's okay.
You were allowed, if you were under 16, to drive between farms. And so I applied for my license at the age of 14 and learned to, my brother had a 1920 Republic truck with solid tires and a wooden open cab, had to crank it, and that's what I learned to drive on. I got my license on a 1931 Model A Ford coupe. It was very easy to park.
Where did they administer the driving test?
The driving test was administered in the armory.
Okay.
And you took your written test there, and then you he went out on Lee Street and parked, and you could, and it was every 2 weeks. You could only go one day. I don't know what day it was, but
that was into the 1980s.
Okay.
My children and my wife took their driver's test on at the Armory on Lee Street, and I have to think about how old the kids were, but that would have been into the 1980s. So, didn't realize it had always been there. So let's go back to the living on William Street. You, how'd you make extra money? How did you earn money for spending?
Well, in the during the war, the Liriodendron was next door, and it actually adjoined our property. And by that time, whoever the caretakers actually wound up leasing the property. That was Clyde Dennis, and he farmed it, and they raised tomatoes, and essentially picked tomatoes. And you could either do it for 10 cents a basket or 50 cents an hour. And I like to listen to the stories of Clyde Dennis, so I did it for 50 cents an hour and helped him with his cattle. And then in 1948, when I graduated from high school, Tommy Brooks, the town engineer of Bel Air, asked me if I would be willing to help a contractor put in the first parking meters. So Jimmy Hopkins and I were paid 75 cents an hour, and we helped this gentleman put in all the parking meters on Main Street. And then when that contract was over, Tommy asked if I would work for the town of Bel Air, and I did during my early years at Loyola. I did on summers and weekends and at Christmas time during the season. Many of the things I did was run a jackhammer. We laid sidewalks, put in sewer lines. And one interesting thing was that Ewing Street, the first street as you come up Churchfield Road past John Carroll and Rockfield Park, the first street to the left is Ewing Street, and at that time it was gravel. And we were going to put penetrating oil. Rather than pave it, they put penetrating oil to keep the dust down. And we had an old grader, which was a horse-drawn grader, but at that time we were pulling it with a tractor. And the Kurt Akers, the foreman, had graded the street. They came in with the truck, and they put penetrating oil on it, and immediately thereafter it rained. And the rain put all the oil down in Charles McComas Sr.'s stream there, and he had a ram bay at the, below the house that pumped the water up to the house. It was kind of like a hydroelectric, so he would. And we had to go in and dig all that oil out of his stream on one of the hottest days of the summer.
Now, you're talking about sidewalks in the write-up that I had to work with. It said that you helped replace the slate sidewalks with concrete?
Well, we did, I don't remember replacing the sidewalks, but I did work on many of the sidewalks and lay curb and gutters. So years ago, I'm sure they've been replaced since, but many of the sidewalks up and down Main Street I helped finish.
But was there any slate in town at that time?
I don't remember that.
Okay.
I can't.
I see that you also did traffic studies?
No.
Okay. Well, that was in the write-up too, so.
Well, maybe that was some of the embellishment that was of my back, but I don't remember doing traffic studies. But I do remember that I ran the tractor. We had a tractor with an old-time sickle bar mower on it, and I would mow the side streets, or if some of the people wanted their lots mowed, I did. And there a lot of time there were complaints when I would leave weeds and mow flowers that since I couldn't tell the difference.
My wife still hollers at me for that. So when you picked the tomatoes at the Kelly, at the Lario, where did they take them, someplace for canning?
Yeah, actually, later when I was working with my brother, we hauled tomatoes for Clyde and hauled them to Baltimore, and in the we would take them down to the market on Broadway, and then there would be somebody that would buy them, and then you would go to whatever canning house. Sometimes there was Lord Mott down at the end of Wolf Street, and I remember, and this is terrible, the people unloading your tomatoes would actually stand up in the middle of your baskets, and so anyway, but we went out to Cross and Blackwell on Eastern Avenue, and there, when you came home with your truck, there would only be just a few spots where a tomato would fall, so I would eat Cross and Blackwell ketchup rather than Lord Mott ketchup.
So did the canning houses in Baltimore pay a better price, or were the canning houses in Harford County?
I don't know why he went to Baltimore.
Okay.
Or whether the canning houses in, say, like Street's canning house up in Hickory, whether that was still operating or not, I don't know.
Okay. Well, let me ask you now, did you use a horse and plow to till the gardens?
Yes.
Okay.
We had 20 acres that was in the town of Bel Air, and where the brick houses are, north of Alice Ann Street, was a 5-acre field, and I had a team of horses, and my brother John had a team of horses, and I remember plowing that field for, I can't remember what grain he planted in it, and then also my brother and I would do custom garden plowing. I had a wagon and take my team of horses wherever we went in Bel Air, and we would plow gardens. And then one winter, I don't know whether it was colic, but one of my horses got sick and had a high fever, and he broke his halter and wound up outside the stall and died within a couple of days. So I'm left without a horse. And during that time, I was getting my teeth straightened down to University of Maryland on Lombard and Green Street. And you wouldn't do this today, but a 14-year-old boy got on McMahon bus here in Bel Air, rode to the Greyhound station in Baltimore on Howard Street, and then I walked over to Lombard and Green, and they worked on me, and when I came out, I hailed a cab and took it over to the Baltimore Stockyards, which was over near Monroe Street. I think the cab cost me 50 cents. The guy probably wasn't very happy with me because I didn't give him a tip. And it was a horse auction, and I bid on a white mare and bought it and looked around and hired myself a truck driver who then brought my horse out to Bel Air. So I think of my grandchildren that I don't even let them. We keep an eye on them here, and when they go in the neighborhood, how you would let your 14-year-old boy do something like that today. Mm-hmm. It's quite an experience.
Where did the McMahon bus, where'd you catch that?
I think it was at Richardson's drugstore, right across the street from Richardson's drugstore.
Okay.
Not quite in front of Lutz's.
Okay, so that would be Pennsylvania and yeah. Maine today.
Yes.
Did you ride? I was going to ask you about the bus, and I was going to ask you about the railroad.
Right. Well, I can remember, you were talking about earlier, this is one thing I can remember. Before the Ma and Pa closed down between their passenger service between Bel Air and Baltimore, my mother and I got on the train, and we went to Baltimore, and she did her shopping, and we came back again. And that was quite a ride.
That would have should have been, I think they closed the passenger around 54.
Well, this would have been in the 40s, mm-hmm. or maybe even the late 30s. Somewhere it would have been 1940 plus or minus. But you also asked me earlier about memories of my childhood growing up on William Street. I can remember that there were a group of boys. There was Joe Foster, who is of the Foster Funeral Home, lived on Gordon Street, and there was William and Donald Finney, who lived on William Street, beyond Gordon Street, and the four of us were kind of a gang, and we would, you know, I would go out and be gone all day. We would play army, and I didn't have one of the, you made your own rifles out of wood, and if you remember, you would get cereal in these little boxes. There would be about 10 of them in a big box, and they were about the size of a walkie-talkie, so you would take those and take a hanger, cut part of the wire, and put it for an antenna, and that was your walkie-talkie. And so we would have war with, it was Nick Greer and Jimmy Hopkins over on Broadway. That was the other gang that, and we would have fake battles.
Where'd your family do grocery shopping in town?
There was the just one store, and that was the A&P on Main Street. Then another job I had around the time I was graduating from high school was to work at the old Acme, which is down by the armory. I was in produce. My job was to put produce up. So that was a part-time job I had also.
How about clothes shopping? Where did they go for that on Main Street?
Well, I can't remember. Of course, you had the Hershey's men's store. I don't know where I bought my childhood clothes. Probably my mother bought them in Hutchler's in Baltimore.
Okay.
I don't know that for sure, but I knew she was a Hutchler shopper. And one of the things that Captain Jim mentioned in was my selling race programs down to racetrack. I was about 13 years old, and I worked in the office there at the racetrack, and I had the privilege of selling the programs, and I bought my pencils, cut them in half, and put erasers on them, and I had the clubhouse to myself. And and that didn't go over well with those that were in the grandstand, so I was replaced later on, and then I went picking tomatoes.
Well, the how long was the racing season at the racetrack?
Seemed to me like it was 10 days, if I remember correctly. It wasn't a long, long season. And then, you know, Haverty Grace was operating then, because I remember we would get horses from Haverty Grace.
Now, this was the regular races with the jockeys, not the sulkies.
Right, this was regular. Okay. And then toward the latter part of the summer, they would have the fair.
Okay. Was it similar to the fairs that we see today on Tollgate?
Yeah, only it was in the fairgrounds. They had all people bring their baked goods, and they would have the horse pulls. Instead of the tractor pulls, they would have the horse pulls. Mm-hmm. And they were judging horses, and I can remember they had all these heavy teams of Percherons and Belgian horses, and I took my little old horse, and when they were judging single horses and pulled them up in there, of course I didn't get a prize, but I...
But I'd also like to spend some time talking about your siblings who had some service in the county.
Let's start at the top, just put the record straight. My oldest sister is Betty O'Neill, and she married Charles McComas, who was one of your Living Treasure interviewees.
Yes.
And they lived most of their time on a sailboat between Bel Air and Florida, Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Then the next one is Brother John, who was in the war, and he served on a ship as a gunnery officer, and then came here and started farming. And initially, the farming was done on our 20 acres. Then he bought a farm on Hall Street, at the end of Hall Street, which is now development near where the Noyes farm is. And then he bought the farm now, which is on Grafton Shops Road. So during his whole life, he was a farmer, but then he became an auctioneer. And then he was the first, before that, he was a county commissioner. And then when, I don't know the date, but when we became a charter government, he was the first council president. Then he tried to run for county executive against Charlie Anderson. And of course that was during the Nixon years, and we know that it was difficult for a Republican to get any office. He probably could have gotten reelected as a county council president, but not as county executive.
But it was still a close election from what Mr. McMahon wrote up. So who was next?
Next was my sister Peggy. She married Buckner Creel, who lived up in Darlington. And as a side, my brother Tom married his sister, Connie Creel. So, Buck was in the military and spent all of his life. So Peggy was a military wife and traveled with Buck, and they raised five children. And then Tommy was part of Harford County that would be of interest is that when he served in World War II as a meteorologist and actually helped predict the weather for the invasion of Normandy, because he was in Wales there at the time. And then when he came home, he stayed in the Naval Reserve and was a clerk or assistant for my father when he was down in Annapolis as a state senator. And he was studying for his law degree, and he had just a semester to complete when they called him back in the Navy during the Korean War. And he elected to stay in the Navy. He couldn't get out of the, he couldn't join the, see, he had to join the regular Navy as a lieutenant or stay in the reserve as a lieutenant commander. So he elected to join the regular Navy. And he got his master's degree in meteorology and his PhD in meteorology and retired and lived in Falls Church, Virginia. So then the next one is Jimmy, and my brother Jim just passed away at the age of 86. And he was a lawyer here in Harford County, and he became a town commissioner and eventually served several tours as mayor.
Of Bel Air.
Of Bel Air.
Yes.
And then the next one is Nancy, and that was my sister, and with my father and mother kind of progressing in age, Nancy stayed home to kind of help take care of the household there on William Street until their passing. And then she moved to Houghton, Maine after that. And that brings you to yours truly.
Number seven.
Eight.
Oh, I miscounted some.
There's Betty, Johnny, Peggy, Tommy, Harry. Missed one.
We missed Harry. That's why I only had seven.
Okay, I'm sorry. Between Tommy and Jimmy, how could I forget Brother Harry? Harry served in World War II as a sergeant, and he actually fought in the Battle of the Bulge and stepped on a landmine. Fortunately, it was a shoe mine buried in the snow, so it only destroyed part of his foot. But there was some thought that he might lose his leg, but he didn't. And then he went to school, law school, got his law degree, and he was in with my father as a lawyer and spent his whole life as a lawyer until, and he became a magistrate when they had the old magistrate system. And then when they were converted to district judges, he became a full-time district judge in the Risto building on Bond Street. And he had a farm in Falston. And about 15 years ago, he was one of the first residents of Oakcrest down on Wolf of Boulevard and still lives there now. He also, while he was living in Falston, became an ordained deacon at St. Mark's Catholic Church.
And then worked at Oakcrest, right?
Yeah, and at Oakcrest he was very active in the diaconate, and he unfortunately developed spinal stenosis, which made it very painful to walk, and when they divided up his duties, it was between 12 and 15 people that they gave his duties to.
Wow. He must have been busy when he was
I kind of did that too, but he claims that they were part-time. They told him about part-time people.
And the other thing I guess we should have mentioned along the way was listeners for your brother John, that would be O'Neill Enterprises today.
Yes.
In Forest Hill.
Yeah. His daughters, Amy and Mary Lou, still operate that.
Yes. And I see that the public service continues with her, and she's on the board of a local one of the schools.
Okay.
Can't remember which school it is though.
If I may, there's another area I'd like to talk about.
Please.
We started with Humphrey Wilson, and being a member of the St. Ignatius Church in 1792. And that has continued down through the years. And I am currently a member of St. Ignatius. And I had the privilege of being on the building committee for building the new church. And Doc Street and I helped make the week-to-week decisions with a contractor. But our architect brought to us that there was this artisans in Peru who made carvings, and he thought that we ought to purchase some of our artifacts from there. So we procured a Station of the Cross. This for those that don't know, this is a 14 picture light passion of passion and death of our Lord Jesus. And we got the sixth station, where Veronica meets, where Veronica wipes the face of Jesus. That was the sixth statue. And based on the faith of that one, we paid $500 for it. Based on that statue, we had carvings of the life of St. Ignatius on the front of our front doors. We have mahogany doors, and we have the life of Saint from his birth on. You can follow it in these carvings all the way to his death as you go in the front door. And then we got all the statues. There are four statues, one of St. Ignatius of the Blessed Mother, five, St. Joseph, Mother Seton, and the Sacred Heart statue. And then we got a beautiful cross on the front of is a beautiful cross about 14, 16 feet tall that almost looks lifelike, a crucifix with Jesus on it. And then they, based on drawings that I sent down there, they carved the altar and the ambo and the lectern and all the chairs. And then the other thing that, although I think Captain Jim mentioned in his write-up in this was not quite correct. He mentioned the stained glass, implying that they came from Peru, but they came from Baltimore. And we had an artist who essentially, we looked at about two or three proposals when we were getting our stained glass, and the one that impressed us is this fellow proposed having our clear story windows. There are 50 of them, and they tell the whole life of Christ through these 50 windows. And then we have two beautiful rose windows, and then we have stained glass windows. And the design of the windows were taken from the old church. They were we tried to recreate as much as the old church and the new church as possible. And one of my job was to see that the architect didn't make it a monument to himself, but rather look as if it were built in the late 1700s or early 1800s. And our architect essentially designed it as a cathedral. And it's still today, when I go in there, it's just awesome with all the wainscoting and the statues and the stained glass windows. And I feel honored to have had some part in the development of the church.
The old chapel there is very interesting too. It's now like a little mini museum.
Yeah, well, the chapel is still a functioning church.
Mm-hmm.
And they have mass in it twice every day. And then to the side of it is where originally, I don't know, it may have been the rectory for the high, initially, and then it was a school, and now it's a museum. And all, a lot of the things from the past are displayed there.
Let me see, if I remember right, that's the oldest church in America, isn't it? A Catholic church in America.
I think operating one. It may not be the oldest, but I think it's the oldest operating one.
Operating, okay.
It's on the National Registry.
It's a very pretty building, and the new building is very pretty, too.
Yes.
You did a nice job on that. So, let me see. There was, I was setting up equipment and stuff, there was one more topic, at least, that I want to have you talk about a little bit. When you worked at Aberdeen Proving Ground,
yes,
you were talking about the, you were there even during the forerunner of the ENIAC computer. Can you just talk about the changes that you've seen at Aberdeen as far as technology?
I went to Aberdeen Proving Ground in 1952, just graduating from college, and later in the years, the room that I was my office was where the digital analyzer was. It was not, I don't think it was operating at that time, but some of our main computers was the ENIAC, which the Ballistics Research Laboratories contracted with the University of Pennsylvania Moore School of Engineering, and von Neumann was involved with that, and that was our first computer, and it was operating then when I first went there. And then we had the ORDVAC was the next one, and it was a tubes and it could probably fill about half of this room. And it could do not as much as you can do with your little handheld calculators today. It essentially did pluses and minuses and all. So, and then the last computer that BRL was involved with was called the Burlesque. It was the BRL Electronic Scientific Calculator computer. And that was the last one they built. And then, as I saw, they got more supercomputers, but they bought them from IBM. And then before I left, we had our own personal computers that we finally got the PCs. And one of the things that, you know, the it wasn't Al Gore, but it was the Army that developed the ARPANET, which was a forerunner to the Internet.
Internet, yeah.
And when we would go on travel, we would have a little computer, which was about the half size of a, or a quarter size of a today's keyboard. And it had an eight-line screen with a little keyboard on it. And you would have an acoustical device. You would put your phone in it, and then you could log on to the computer at Aberdeen Proving Ground and get your email messages.
That's pretty good.
So.
Pretty good. Now, during your time there, well, you spent a lot of time at Aberdeen. I'm not sure what the title or the position was, but obviously you had some folks working under you. And in the write-up here, it says that one of your staff actually testified at the Warren Commission investigation of Kennedy.
That was not one of my cohorts.
Okay.
He had the infantry branch. I had the artillery branch, and I remember the day that Kennedy was shot, and I went one day into our security office, and there was this box, and there was Oswald's rifle was in that box, and they essentially would test it to see how many rounds that they could get off. But if you're interested, I went in 1952. I went in and worked in the armored area in tank warfare for 3 years, and then my deferment became 1A, and I had joined the reserves. So I volunteered for active duty, and spent 2 years at Fort Bliss with the Office of Special Weapons Development, where we determined the tactics and for nuclear weapons. And one of the things I remember working on was the damage and safety criteria, how low you could explode a nuclear Nike Hercules if you had to explode it over the United States. And then I spent a year at General Electric in Philadelphia working on nuclear weapons, and then I came back home to Aberdeen Proving Ground in 1958, and I was in the artillery branch and worked there, where I was a section chief, and then I became chief of the branch. And we were the weapons systems lab of the Ballistics Research Laboratories, and they were pulled out and made what one would consider a weapons effectiveness group for the Army. We were the Army Material Systems Analysis Activity. And I became a chief of the Air Warfare Division, and for the rest of my career was basically as a division chief, a senior executive, and worked on things like the Apache attack helicopter and Patriot. And then in my last 3 years, I transferred, my boss asked me to take over another division, the Reliability Division, and I spent the last 3 years working on the reliability of Army weapons. Then I retired in 1986, and for 10 years I was a consultant to Ballistic Missile Defense in Alexandria, Virginia. I retired the second time in 2002, and worked on one of my loves, which I'll have to back up on you now. In 1982, I got my real estate license.
Okay.
And the reason I got my real estate license was my father had property all over Harford County, and it was in the estate. So this was 82. He died in 19, or my mother died in 1967. So all that time, this land was just languishing there. And so, I don't know whether I kind of took the initiative and met with Jimmy, Tommy, some of my brothers, and we decided to put them on the market, and I became the real estate representative for the family, and helped sell all the property. So while I was doing this, Brother John says, I have this, my farm I want to sell. Why don't you market that too? And I happened to be talking to my brother Harry, who was a lawyer, and he says, you can't do that. You're selling real estate without a license if you're working for your brother. So I went off and got my real estate license and practiced part-time over the years. And I went with Harry Hopkins, who is not the Register of Wills, but Harry G. Hopkins in Churchville, who was a farmer in Darlington. And with my love of land, I worked mostly on selling land throughout the county. And one of my two recent sales, one was, it was originally Hackley Reserve, and now it's Magnolia Reserve, which is a large townhouse development in Joppa. And Perryman Station, which is a housing development, apartments for subsidized senior housing.
So let's talk a little bit about obviously land sale and traffic and people and everything is one of the big changes in the county. So can you talk a little bit about changes that you've seen that you like?
The changes that I've seen that I like. No, I see a lot of changes that I don't like.
Okay, well, that's pretty typical of the folks I talk to.
One of the, when I first went to work for Harry, we had a contract which was a legal paper front and back. And now I prepare a contract and there are 40 pages with about a 14, 15 page contract with all kinds of addendums, and you have to almost read a customer with the Miranda rights to tell them that you either work for them or work for the seller, and that kind of stifles your right off the bat. One of the interesting things that I also do appraising, and as an appraiser, I remember doing some commercial appraising on Route 40, and I couldn't come up with a price. And I had all these different comparables, and I did the per acre price. So I plotted them on a piece of graph paper, and lo and behold, they fit in a straight line, and I could pinpoint the price of the land that I was selling. So I started doing appraisals using regression analysis, which is a mathematical technique to estimate the price of a property for which you don't have an exact comparable. And it particularly works in land sales. Another interesting thing is we were during the bubble, we would watch the value of houses go up, and I would plot those on a graph, and they would be going along, and then the value would go up, and my associate, Tim Hopkins, said, well, they're going to come back down to meet what was this straight line projection, and lo and behold, today they have prices have come back down and are basically on that original glide path of appreciating about 5% a year.
So, that's interesting.
The things I guess I do like is when I first went there, you would get your listings would be in a yellow box. Every day would be delivered these sheets, and you would have to put them in folders and keep tabs of them. And today you have your listings on the computer. And we had our tax maps, and if you want to give somebody a tax map, you had to put it on the copying machine and explode it, essentially enlarge it. And now I can go on with a program that I have from the state of Maryland, and I can get any size tax map I want and can put soils maps on it or contour map or aerials maps on it. So yes, that's a big, the technology associated with real estate is fantastic. In fact, now and I'm almost falling behind the times. You have them now on your phones, and I'm not quite ready to go there yet.
Well, let me see. But the only thing that I've skipped in my list of normal questions, and I'd have to back you up at this point, is what'd you do for entertainment in your youth?
Well, that...
other than play soldier.
I was going to go with my moderate use, and we've overlooked the significant part of my life. And it's last but not least. And... when I was 16 years old, there were five boys that ran around town. There was Charlie Smith, there was Carl Hamby, Paul Nieper, and Francis Vanderweel. And we were kind of a group, and we've stayed together as an aside ever since, because every year at New Year's we've gotten together since 1955. Even though three of them, unfortunately, have passed away. But Carl and I were good friends, and we were noted for dating sisters. And then he was dating a Lucille Dalton. And she got her sister to go out with me. And this was on the 7th of May in 1950. And we went to the Mason-Dixon Speedway for stock car races. But Mason-Dixon Speedway is no longer there, but it's just over the line on Route 1 going toward Oxford.
Okay.
And then that was it ever since. We went together for 5 years. And when I was home from basic training, and thought I was headed to Fort Monroe. We were driving down the road, and I said, I had given her a ring several years before. And I said, let's get married. And so that was a Thursday. We were married on the following Tuesday. And the next thing we knew, when I reported in to Fort Monroe, Virginia, they said, oh, you're the one that's supposed to be in Fort Bliss, Texas. They had made a mistake on my orders. Mm-hmm. And so the next thing we knew, the following week, we had an all-expense-paid honeymoon to Fort Bliss, Texas, and we spent 2 years there. And when we came back, we went to Philadelphia, then we lived on Eastern Avenue, and my brother Jim's house for a year. And in 1959, we moved into this house on Lakeside Drive. Hmm. And have lived here ever since. And we have three children. Mark O'Neill was born in 1957. He's in the radio business. And he lives in Marina Del Rey, California. I have a son, Howard, who is an engineer. Started out as a civil engineer and wound up as an agricultural engineer. And he worked for a lot of the engineering firms here in town. And he lives in West Virginia. And my youngest daughter, Mary Lynn, lives in Glenville. And one thing of interest there was that they were building their house, and my son-in-law's father, his uncle, his brother, my son-in-law and I built their house. It took us about 2 years to do it.
Very good. Well, is there any other topics that you'd like to...
No, I think... I'm willing to answer any questions you have, but I think I have covered everything that I had in mind.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we've gone around the county pretty good, and your family, your whole family has certainly made a large contribution to the county. So it's been a pleasure, sir.
Pleasure speaking with you.
Okay, I'm going to say thanks very much.
Yes, sir.